Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, joined as usual today by Jane Costin from Chicago and ProPublica's Dara Lind. We are going to talk about impeachment, which is the talk of the town. We had solicited questions from readers, viewers, listeners, et cetera, in the Vox community. And what I found was a lot of people were interested in sort of the nuts and bolts process stuff, which has people don't do like scoops about how Senate rules work. So it hasn't really been in the news. So I sort of wanted to start there. I mean, one interesting thing about this is that, of course, the president has not been impeached. And the House has not taken any votes on anything. It's just a kind of with a wave of the hand, Nancy Pelosi proclaimed that it is now an impeachment inquiry. And if you find that confusing, it just is confusing. That's just how it works, right? Like there's nothing more to it. And then people were interested in the Senate trial. And the way this works, if you look back at the Clinton impeachment of 1998, is that the Senate just makes up the rules as it goes along. And so they had early in the process these sort of contested votes where it was, will there be any witnesses at all? And Democrats had moved to have no witnesses, to basically like muff the whole trial and just move to a quick vote. But Republicans had a majority, so they said there would be witnesses. Then impeachment enthusiasts wanted like a trial, like a Law and Order episode with witnesses on the stand, and they thought it would turn public opinion around. Democrats didn't want to do that, and the more vulnerable Republicans thought impeachment was unpopular, and they kind of wanted to cut it short. So they reached this compromise where witnesses did sworn depositions on tape, and then excerpts of the tapes were played by impeachment managers in the Senate. Which is just to say, like, they can do whatever they want. And Mitch McConnell has said that his understanding of the rules is that he would have to hold a trial if the House votes to impeach. But that's all he has said. They could do literally anything from, like, the trial of the century to a six-minute vote in which, you know, like, Democrats don't have 67 votes and it's all over. So the impeachment denouement It could be very unimpressive.
There's kind of an underlying timing question here, which was addressed in a couple of the questions we got, which were basically like some version of how long is it going to take for the House to actually impeach, or why is the House, you know, now kind of rushing forward on impeachment after Nancy Pelosi spent so many months saying that they weren't ready to open an inquiry yet and they weren't going to, et cetera, et cetera. The Democrats' logic has been, or at least, you know, Democratic leadership in the House has been that, you know, they appear to be treating what has happened or what's come to light about Trump's involvement in Ukraine and his, you know, requests and the State Department's pressure to get strong anti-corruption language that may or may not literally be just investigate Hunter Biden as kind of they're treating it as enough of a smoking gun that they're really kind of rushing forward with this. They want, you know, they've said that they want a vote on impeachment before the end of the year, which really is not that much time, given that it's already October. And also given that we spent so many months with them not really taking any action on impeachment. So you can kind of see this one of two ways. The Democratic leadership appears to be believing that if they treat this as a smoking gun, that the public will agree and that they just need to like get to impeachment and say we've impeached the president, the Senate, you know, does its thing. And also in case impeachment turns out to not be such a political winner for them, they have all of 2020 to like state their own agenda, which Nancy Pelosi has always been very big on, like not being purely reactive to the president, but also offering an alternative vision. There is a critique that doesn't appear to be breaking down along ideological lines, except insofar as, you know, people in the left of the Democratic Party often find more reasons to fault Nancy Pelosi right now than people in the centrist wing. This is squandering prime media real estate, right? That there are not that many, that like there are going to be a lot of news cycles in 2020 that now are going to be dominated by things other than the House hammering impeachment. And as somebody who is not as, you know, plugged into the kind of optics of daily news cycles as y'all, like, that strikes me as a moderately persuasive argument, but I'd love to know what kind of the kind of downside risk is of a more protracted impeachment process.
So something I'm interested in is, like, I want to back up a little bit because I think that there's an idea of how we think about impeachment that is perhaps slightly inaccurate. So a couple of the questions we got are like, why impeach him for this, but not for Yemen or for the situation on the border or for lying about thousands of different things? And also like the idea of what impeachment is supposed to do, because impeachment, though it will involve legal questions, is not really like the idea of high crimes and misdemeanors. I think, Matt, maybe we could get into that a little bit, because This is not law and order. I wish it were, because God, I love law and order. But this is not, it's a political question, not so much a legal one exactly.
Yeah, and some people had asked about, you know, like what laws did Trump break here potentially? And they asked specific, other people who knew better are aware that like, it seems like technically you could construe this whole thing as a violation of campaign finance law.
Yes.
Because it is a crime to solicit something of value from a foreign entity for the purposes of your political campaign. So if you wanted to hang a legal charge on Rudy Giuliani, I guess in particular, I think that might be what you would want to say. But I think fundamentally the point is that impeachment is not about law in that sense, right?
Yes.
Like if you caught the president like jaywalking across 17th Street, like that's illegal, but you obviously wouldn't impeach someone over that.
Right. Like I think the Mueller report might have distorted the discourse on this a little bit, because the conclusion of the Mueller report on the obstruction of justice stuff was we didn't think about whether the president could be prosecuted for a crime, because we have guidance that we can't prosecute the president for a crime. There is a political remedy for this, and that remedy is impeachment. That is, it is simultaneously true that mainstream interpretation of the DOJ's authority says that you cannot prosecute the president because impeachment's the only way to remove him, and that impeachment is not limited to the, you know, violations of the U.S. code in the strict sense.
I mean, the basic question of impeachment is the magnitude of the inappropriateness,
yes,
right? And the ability to forge a consensus in Congress about the inappropriateness. And the key thing here, I'm going to kick it back to Jane with this, but the key thing here seems to me to be that a number of Republicans are willing to say that they feel this was at least inappropriate, right? I mean, there's a question as to how far Ben Sasse, Mitt Romney, others will go in their criticisms of these dealings with Ukraine. But like they are, in fact, critical of it, which means Democrats can both all be very critical of it and also can say it's not a foregone conclusion that Republicans won't turn on him over this, because some of them have.
Well, the question is, though, that what the statements we've gotten even from Mitt Romney have basically been like, this is bad, but it's not impeachable bad. And that seems to be the basic sentiment, like among conservatives who are Trump leaning conservatives. So let's say that there are about three groups. There is the, this isn't illegal, everyone does this, everyone should do this, why are you so mad about it? And we'll call that kind of the Federalist wing. Then there's the, this is bad, but not impeachable. Actually, let's look back at Obama kind of thing. And if you, there was an op-ed that was from the Tucker Carlson and his fellow founder of the Daily Caller a couple of days ago that was basically like, sure, Trump shouldn't have done this, but really, like, hasn't this happened before? It's not illegal. It's just unseemly. And yeah, you know, so we'll call that the Daily Caller wing. And then there's been the Mitt Romney. This is very concerning. I've raised both of my eyebrows and put them down at the same time. Kind of response, which is, you know, this is bad. We would say it's bad if it were someone else. We should be able to say it's bad when it's Trump. That does not necessarily mean that we're getting towards impeachment in the Senate bad. And there's been some reporting from Gabriel Sherman and the Vanity Fair, who's talked about how, you know, this isn't Romney trying to launch a primary candidacy. This is him trying to see if he can circle at least one or two wagons to get people on board, perhaps in the Senate. Now, again, we're not sure of the veracity of all of that, because occasionally these are the kinds of things that get reported that are like, that get people super excited and then nothing happens, which is often what happens in reporting in general. But there are kind of the three of the Trump's leaning conservatives, those seem to be the three basic wings. Though I do want to go back, because I think that, you know, a couple of people have asked this question, like, is it, you know, why is this an impeachable offense as opposed to one other potentially impeachable offense? There have been numerous arguments. I think there's a piece in New Republic about this, like, you know, we should actually just have an impeachment hearing that's about everything Trump has done. And then there's been the response that, like, you know, from conservatives, like, you've been trying to impeach him since Inauguration Day, that kind of thing. But then also, like, you know, has this happened before? Have there been, because I think that there's been references to, you know, how the Ukraine was involved in 2016, which is how this whole story goes, because we're going to repeat 2016 for the rest of our natural lives. So I think getting into, like, what actually took place here that we know of, and, you know, why is that an impeachable offense, or perhaps arguably an impeachable offense if you are among the Democrats who, and the some Republicans not in Congress, who are favoring impeachment?
I think that the argument that Democrats have been trying to impeach Trump since Inauguration Day is particularly striking, because this is exactly the discourse that Nancy Pelosi has been trying to avoid for the last 9 months, mm-hmm. right? Like, by taking the House majority and immediately saying, instead of impeaching President Trump, which, by the way, we can do now, we are just going to engage in vigorous oversight. And then, for one thing, the vigorous oversight has really not yielded results. There's been unprecedented stonewalling by the executive branch. The stuff that we've found out about hasn't really come from Congress making these very, you know, harshly worded, these sternly worded letters to the White Star Line, really. But, you know, has in fact come from kind of whistleblowers within the government and scoops from outside and that kind of thing. But if you argue, if you spend months and months and months arguing, yes, we oppose the president, we think that he's not legitimate, but we also aren't going to impeach him, a lot of people don't hear the second part of that argument. And so I think that, you know, it is both facially untrue that Democrats have been trying to impeach Trump since inauguration, if you think of Democrats as the Democrats who can actually do the impeaching, and a reflection of, I think, how weird the House strategy on this has been.
But I think Democrats need to rethink a little bit, right? Because essentially what's been going on is politics, right? I mean, Democrats come in and it's true, like, some members were like hot to trot with impeaching Trump. And the more vulnerable members were not, because it didn't poll well. And then leadership, whose job is to build consensus in the caucus and protect the vulnerable members, said they were against impeachment. Then, like, there is a group of cranky pundits on Twitter who, to be frank, like, their mission in life is to just take whatever it is Democrats are doing and say it's wrong. So, like, 100% of the people who were complaining that they were impeaching, that they weren't impeaching Trump, were the people who 6 months earlier had been complaining that Democrats were talking too much about Russia. You know what I mean? And then, like, now that Pelosi got on board with impeachment because the politics change, it's like, oh, no, I'm instead of saying, like, thank you, Nancy Pelosi, for doing what I've been saying you should be doing, it's like, no, now you're impeaching Trump wrong. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's tedious. Like, I completely respect and understand the view that the public policy convictions of moderate Democrats are mistaken and it would be better to instead have more left-wing views. But, like, it would be healthier to just say that rather than, like, continually just taking the opposite side of every tactical question.
Right.
And so, like, the baseline reason the Democrats are pressing forward with the Ukraine focus is that the polling on it is pretty good. It's not great, I should say. I mean, it's not great in the sense that lots of people who otherwise love Donald Trump seem outraged by this Ukraine thing, but it's reasonably unifying. Like, it used to be Trump was unpopular, but impeachment was also unpopular. Now Trump is unpopular, and the people who don't like Trump seem to want to have this impeachment inquiry. So, like, that's why Democrats are doing it. But the only thing I would say is that, like, I think they need to guide themselves by the politics now, right? And, like, going back over stuff that's already been hashed out seems like a bad idea. But, like, opening the door on new stuff that hasn't really been hashed out before and saying it's, like, part of the impeachment inquiry, because, like, the president of Ukraine mentions to Trump that he's staying at his hotel. So that strikes me as, like, a valid pretext to, like, go digging around in general Trump hotel type antics.
Right. Or for that matter, you know, if after Trump said on television last week, you know, China, if you would like to investigate Joe Biden, like, in the middle of trade talks, what is going on there? There are definitely some other avenues that if you wanted to build a pattern and practice of using foreign relations for personal and domestic gain, you could do that.
At a minimum, like, ask Robert Lighthizer to come down and say, has the president ever suggested to you that, you know, and, like, maybe the answer is no, right? Like, legitimately, like, part of oversight is that, like, sometimes the executive branch has not done anything wrong. And in some ways, it might be healthy to, like, throw some accusations like that out there that the Trump administration might want to respond to. Because, like, right now they're stonewalling everything, right?
But, like, literally, as we speak, the ambassador to Ukraine is professes to be very, very sad that he cannot testify before Congress today.
But, like, I think it is both a valid question as to whether the U.S. Trade Representative's office has ever been instructed to put Hunter Biden into U.S.-China trade talks.
Right.
And also very plausible that they haven't been, right? That, like, they can just come there under oath and be like, yeah, that never happened. And be like, well, what did you think of the president's tweet? And be like, I don't really know, man, the president tweets stuff. And, like, that would be healthy for the country, right? Rather than, like, Democrats ask for damning information, then the White House doesn't turn it over, and then Democrats... Previously, the stonewalling had been so successful because leadership had been so afraid of doing impeachment that they had no escalation options. And now that's changed. And you know, I think leadership, though, needs to consider in an environment where they now look like they do want to do impeachment. How does that change their tactical approach to all kinds of other things? From back in an era when they faced pressure from their base to do impeachment, but that they didn't want to do it.
We should probably take a break. Mm. But I do want to know more about what this escalation stuff is, because that's definitely – we got a ton of questions about, like, if they continue to stonewall, what can the Congress do? And I don't know these things, but I gather that other people in this podcast do.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So something I want to get at, you know, I think, one, let's talk about escalation. But two, I think how much of impeachment is actually about like a public relations question? And it's been interesting because people keep talking. I mean, the only instances of impeachment that anyone in living memory can think about, unless there is someone out there with Andrew Johnson personal experience, which if you have that experience, please email us. But there are people, you know, Watergate and the Clinton hearings were entirely dependent on how voters and viewers saw those trials. And so I think the basic conceit of why we're focused on Ukraine and not on, you know, Yemen or the border or the host of other issues. I mean, even yesterday talking about Syria that you could hypothetically impeach the president for, is that this is a pretty easy storyline if you can keep it contained to explain in about 30 seconds, kind of the elevator pitch. But I am interested because, you know, we're seeing right now Trump tweeting as we speak about how this is a kangaroo court. And so he's not going to permit this ambassador, or the government is not going to permit this ambassador to testify. And, you know, we've heard about kind of subpoenas and this idea of holding Giuliani in contempt because he won't testify. And people, lawyers sending messages in Comic Sans font, which really, you know, that really understates the seriousness with which many people are taking this. So I'd be interested, you know, Matt, if you could kind of talk us through what exactly can Congress do if the Trump administration is like, we're just not going to do this.
I think Democrats are thinking about this the wrong way, right? But so technically, like, what can happen? The way I think Democrats want this to go is they make these requests, Trump stonewalls, that makes him look guilty. And also, right, in the Madisonian framework, there should be Republican Party senators who are Senate veterans who at this point in their lives are clearly not going to become president of the United States. You know, just guys like kicking around there, right? You know, as there always are. And these Senate old timers should be upset at the diminution of the powers of Congress as an institution. And this causes them to start turning on Trump, right, creating problems with him and escalating the pressure on him to cooperate with Congress. And the fact is that, like, Congress doesn't work like that anymore, and it hasn't worked like that for a while. Watergate, and not only, like, the real facts of Watergate, but, like, literally the movie made about Watergate, is very influential in American political culture, right? But like that movie is a fictionalization of a book, which itself is not like a totally honest depiction of what happened in a completely different period in American politics. And I think it would be useful for Democrats to think less about how a corrupt president was reined in 1973, and more about how corrupt leaders were forced from office in the past 10 years in South Korea, in Spain, in Romania. And in all of these cases, what was required was mass protest in the streets. That's the escalation from ordinary politics to extraordinary politics. Obviously, Nancy Pelosi can't snap her fingers and like cause mass mobilization to exist. But leaders, particularly because leaders talk to union leaders, you know, environmental group leaders, major donors, they talk to the media. They have ways of communicating what kinds of things they want to see and what kinds of things they don't want to see. And we're so far from that poll, right? Like there was an Axios article recently saying that the prospects for the USMCA agreement were actually looking better thanks to impeachment. And I don't know if this was true or not, because it's sometimes hard to tell with these blind items. But what they were saying is that like Pelosi wants to show that Congress can still get things done despite impeachment. So that's leaning on her even more to like want to go put this forward. And I don't know if that's true or not. But what's clearly true is that we are not seeing the opposite, right? She isn't saying, look, if you're going to refuse to engage with completely legally valid congressional requests, there's no way we can move forward on this. Right? That would be like a small way of pressure. A bigger way of pressure, this guy, the ambassador to the EU, right? He also owns a chain of luxury hotels, mostly in the Pacific Northwest. And like, I don't know, right? Like the mayor of Seattle could send the health inspector into the kitchens at all his hotels. And he could say, oh, you're just hassling me because you're my political enemy. And the mayor of Seattle could say, yeah, fuck you. Right? Like, yeah, like.
Or, you know, no, I'm just very, very interested in, you know, in right. hotel I sanitation. Mean, and frankly, just like you're very, very interested in rooting out corruption.
Right. And like, frankly, there's more than one mayor. It's like the mayor of Seattle could say, fuck you. The mayor of Portland could pretend it's about something else. There could be a crowd. You could get an egg thrown on your face if you were walking out of one of this guy's hotels. You know, there are ways to escalate. And the ways that you escalate in like mass politics are not like inside the four walls of the United States Capitol. And in 2017, when Democrats clearly had no power on Capitol Hill, this is what they did. Right. So I don't think they like don't know how it works. They have decided that that's too risky and they don't want to go there.
Right. I mean, I think that part of it is that it looks like Democrats have sorted themselves into the party of order Muppets. Right. Like they have decided that being a party that cares about norms and governance, at least elected Democrats, is very important to their brand as a party. The other part of it, though, is that like when you're talking about, you know, eggs getting thrown in people's faces, there's definitely a belief among, you know, the conventional DC Democratic type of person that mass mobilization is politically polarizing, right? That people who are currently softly in favor of impeachment and don't really like what Trump is doing will be motivated to support Trump if they see lots and lots of people out in the streets against him, especially if those people are doing anything more confrontational than holding signs. And I don't know that we've seen that that is true. And I don't know that, you know, how sensitive to the gravity of the wrong it is. But the idea that elected Democrats would be in league with people who are playing the quote unquote outside game goes against 2017 aside. And I think 2017 has been a little bit memory hold, frankly, in 2019, now that Democrats actually have the House. It goes against a generation of how Democratic Party insiders think governance is supposed to work.
Now, I think that it's weird because I'm in two minds on this question, because I think that, yes, there would be kind of the response from, you know, from the RNC and from like conservative media, like, oh, these Democrats, like we're trying to get real stuff done, which no, they're not trying to get real stuff done. It's not as if Congress has been this bastion of productivity over the last 2 years, because everything, you know, what besides judges, nothing has really gotten through the Senate, despite the House's efforts to do things. But also, you know, we've seen this kind of fetishization in some media outlets of like, you know, of coming together or the end of divisiveness, which the idea that like divisiveness is the worst thing that could possibly happen in this country is stupid. And I'll say that here and now. However, I do think that so much of this question relies on Democrats in some way appearing to be above the fray, above egg throwing or, you know, hypothetical. I'm just trying to think of like how this would somehow get spun to involve Antifa. And this entire idea that like, you know, everyday people, sure, they're concerned and waggling their eyebrows about what Trump has done, but they're, you know, but people value order more than anything else. Again, I would be interested to see some research or polling on how true that is. But I do think that, especially in D.C., the idea, it's a confrontational issue, because on the one hand, you're getting base Democrats and people on the left saying, like, fuck these people. We need to get this guy out. What he is doing is wrong. And if we look bad while doing it, well, so what? But then I do think that there are people, you know, who are representing districts that very much were like, we sent you in during the midterms because we're, you know, in suburban conservative leaning districts who still elected Democrats like Abigail Spanberger and others, because they basically were like, we are not going to get involved in whatever Trump is doing. All we are trying to do is really focus on what our districts want. And our districts are, you know, they're not Trump fans, but they're not super big fans of the idea of Democrats, not Democrats specifically, not like they'll be like, I like my representative. But then, you know, when Democrats, when you say that word, somehow it turns into just referencing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or some sort of like people who lean further left than some of these districts are, think that they would like to go. And so I do think that there's this kind of this weird tension. And I'm not really sure. I mean, I'm very glad that I am not a congressional Democrat, because I don't know how you address that.
I think that there's something to be said for the fact that we are focusing so much on congressional Democrats and their strategy in the impeachment phase rather than the thing that's actually the open question, which is impeachment appears to be a foregone conclusion at this point. You know, whether he will actually get convicted in the Senate appears to probably very few people would bet on that outcome. But we did get a lot of questions like, how could a pro-impeachment citizen move Mitch McConnell? Like, what is the world in which Mitch McConnell's mind changes? And that's a very good question to which we do not have the answer. I think a lot of the reason that it's important to focus on Democrats in this phase isn't just because, like, a lot of D.C. has adopted the mindset that you focus on Democrats because they're the ones who can be expected to be rational actors, although I think that that is the underlying assumption that drives a lot of punditry. But also that how impeachment gets done sets up the Senate trial.
Right.
And so they're really, we genuinely don't know what the politics of this are going to look like coming out of impeachment. That is something that Democrats, whether they like it or not, have a certain amount of control over.
I would say, though, right, in terms of Republicans, I think a constructive thing for, you know, people who live in these states to do, and also for home state journalists in particular who get to ask these people questions, is to ask there are basically three Senate Republicans, Susan Collins, Cory Gardner, and Martha McSally, who are at serious risk of losing reelection bids in 2020. Gardner in particular is like very, very, very serious risk. They have been asked in sort of different ways, like what they think about this phone call. Collins has indicated that she thinks it's bad, has not like gone beyond that. McSally and Gardner have successfully like hidden in mysterious bunkers and not addressed this. But it would be good to hear what they have to say to bring pressure to bear on them about some of these process questions,
yes.
Right? Because, like, this is the basic thing. If you are in that position, if you are Cory Gardner, right, he's trying to walk the difficult line of the swing state senator. He needs to show voters in Colorado, the median Colorado voter, is not a Trump fan. He needs to do something to show independence from Trump and the Republican Party. He also, though, he doesn't want to end up on the other side of the kind of tweets Trump threw at Mitt Romney, because Mitt Romney is like a Mormon political superstar who can hand his head high in Utah no matter what. Gardner's not like that, right? Like, he needs regular Republicans in Colorado to like him. But like, an easy way for him to get some distance is to say, look, the president says he did nothing wrong, so I think we should hear from Ambassador Sondland. Right? Because, like, what's Trump going to say about that? Like, no, you're betraying my effort at the cover-up, right? Like, and that is, like, it matters a lot what Republicans say, because a big part of the way public opinion works, right, is that if Democrats are unified on a topic and Republicans are divided, that sends a strong signal to voters who are not that attentive or voters who don't like partisan politics that fundamentally the Democrats are asking for something reasonable. Right. And like that kind of lazy heuristic, like it matters a lot. So even if we're only talking about a tiny handful of Republicans, if it goes from just Mitt Romney is complaining about the phone call to like two or three Republicans are saying, let's put out this stuff, let's let the people testify publicly, then that brings a lot of pressure to bear on Mitch McConnell, because just like how Pelosi let a handful of blue dogs sort of like wag the dog, it's the same thing for McConnell. Like he needs to think about his caucus's interests. And the interest of that caucus is disproportionately driven by the small number of vulnerable members.
Is this a good time to ask Jane to just talk about, like, the role of Mike Pence is something that kind of in a fact-based, how what did Mike Pence know and when did he know it, manner came up in a lot of these questions. But I think there's also the deeper question of, like, and Jane, you wrote about this, I think, you know, article that just came out. Yeah. Why isn't impeach the president, get President Pence instead, more of an like a rallying cry among conservative elites? And why isn't that a very easy escape hatch for the, you know, Cory's Gardner of the world, who are concerned of, you know, who might want to show both loyalty to the Republican Party and an independence from President Trump?
Well, I think, I mean, there are some within kind of conservative elite world who are like, this would all be so much easier if all we had to deal with was, I think that there's a Jim Pethakoukas of the American Enterprise Institute who said, you know, who described him basically as no drama Pence. And I think that there is this idea, especially outside of conservative circles, that, you know, what do you get with Trump that you wouldn't get with Pence, you know, absent constant nonstop chaos and bananas pudding insanity. However, I think that that ignores for a lot of people the point of why they voted for Trump and not for, say, Ted Cruz or Carly Fiorina or virtually any other conservative. Now, granted, if you go back to 2016, a lot of that is because, you know, Rubio and Bush and everybody aimed all their fire at each other and kind of let Trump skate through for a really long time. But I think that there's also this idea created in, you know, during the Kavanaugh hearings and through other instances that, you know, if Pence had been in charge of Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court, Pence would have pulled the nomination the first time that any sort of controversy eked out. I mean, granted, he probably would have nominated Amy Coney Barrett to begin with, but, you know, whatever. But I think that there's also this idea that Pence was brought on the ticket to basically make evangelical Christians happy and pretty much like ease the kind of social conservative-ish, you know, the Mitt Romney of the world, kind of ease their view of this potential administration. But voters really wanted Trump. They didn't care that he wasn't, you know, a quote unquote establishment conservative. They wanted Trump. And, you know, I spoke with Josh Hammer, who's at Daily Wire, who basically said, you know, from a traditional Reaganite National Review-esque three-legged stool of conservatism perspective, Pence is definitely more of a classical conservative. But you don't need, you know, I think that there's a view on the right that you don't need a classical conservative right now. You need a brawler. You need a bulwark against the dangers of the excesses of the left. And you're not going to get that with a Mike Pence, you know. Especially because if you hearken back to before this administration began, you know, when Mike Pence was governor of Indiana, I think there's a view that on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that the state of Indiana attempted to pass, you know, the second that companies like Salesforce and Apple were like, we don't think you should do this, there's a view that the Pence gubernatorial administration basically were like, we won't do this then. You know, and there I think that there are a lot of conservatives who are like, we don't care about the advancement of conservatism. We believe firmly that we are in danger and we are at risk because of the left or Democrats or Nancy Pelosi or drag queen story hour or something. And that the person who is best able to fight back, you know, to, you know, as Hammer told me, the best able to, you know, encapsulate the mentality that refuses to be subdued and easily swept away, is Donald Trump and not Mike Pence. You know, I talked to a couple people who were basically like, Pence has never said anything interesting. He's we don't need him. He's just basically there to be vice president and to not really say things. We did not want him to be president.
Something that's in your piece that I don't think liberals understand is that conservatives very firmly believe both that Brett Kavanaugh was framed and also that Mike Pence would not have stood up for him, linked to that Religious Freedom Restoration Act thing. I feel like most liberals I know have moved on from the whole Kavanaugh thing. But both for red state Democrats who lost narrow Senate races in 2018, they are convinced that the mass protests against Kavanaugh are the reason that they lost. And a lot of conservatives are convinced that this Kavanaugh thing shows that the left isn't on the level. And so if Trump fights a little dirty, that's exactly what you need. Then meanwhile, you have millions of people, people who I know socially, who are I don't know, man, but don't see what a seminal kind of event that was for a lot of people involved in the fight and how they see other things, both the idea of trying to bring the resistance in the streets back is something that moderate Democrats worry about because they think it stampeded them into taking a harder line against Kavanaugh than they're personally comfortable with. And also the right sees it as this horrible outcome that you need a Donald Trump. Whatever it is they think Donald Trump does, it's that he fights back against that.
Which actually brings us back to what we were saying earlier about the fear of mass politics is you both have, the red state Democrats who say the kind of mass mobilizations and the optics of that made it very hard for, made it easier for people to turn out against me because they felt a good man was being smeared. And the fact that on the right, there's been this apocalyptic strain in rhetoric for the last several years that, we're in an existential battle. If Democrats keep pushing this, we're going to have a new civil war, that kind of thing that hasn't resulted in the kind of mass political mobilizations that we've seen from Democrats, but that carries the flavor of, that has scared, I think, a lot of elite liberals and some elite conservatives into believing that there are large swaths of the country that are going to turn out in the streets with guns if anything bad happens to President Trump.
I just want to say to Democrats listening to this, just factually speaking, there is no evidence for the Kavanaugh backlash thesis. And that there are good studies that look at Tea Party rallies and they use rain as an instrument to show localities where there were bigger rallies. I remember Democrats at the time of the Tea Party rallies, they were sure, oh, there's going to be a backlash against this. It's so crazy. But that's not true. Your best news if you were a vulnerable Democrat in 2010 was that if there was bad weather on major Tea Party rally weekends, you didn't get big rallies. Therefore, you didn't get big press coverage of the rally and you did better in the election. And it's the same thing for Women's March stuff, right? Where you had bigger turnout, people do better. You see these same studies in foreign countries. I saw from Dara's Twitter feed, even the LA riots in 1992, if anything is going to spark a backlash, it's people actually going nuts, stealing things, and which I would genuinely not advise.
Yeah, you're totally scooping a white paper that I wanted to propose to later.
I just wanted to, the evidence that is available to us is that highly visible public protests are a very efficacious political tactic
in democracies.
Yes,
which this is very pointedly not an episode about the NBA in China.
Sure, although even there, I don't know. The point is it's of course hard, right? People would just call out mass protests all the time if they could totally control them. But if there's something that you think is a big deal that people are engaged with intellectually, it's a good idea to try to get them to go do stuff and, hold signs. I think my egg throwing idea was a little extreme, but right now they're not doing anything. Trump wanted to cut taxes and Democrats staged huge rallies about it. Right now, Democrats claim to believe that Trump is subverting the basic structure of American democratic politics and the Constitution, which I think is fairly plausible. It's certainly a bigger deal than cutting the corporate tax rate. And, like, they're throwing these subpoenas around. They're getting ignored. Like, they should do something. And I guess
I think it says something about how, you know, and this goes to, I have many hobbies, horses, whatever. One of my basic beliefs is that, like, residential segregation and how what we think of the other side, whatever that is damaging our politics irreparably. Because, you know, when I talk to conservatives and then I talk to liberals, they both think that the other has this, the ability to assemble people en masse to do whatever it is they want at the drop of a hat, at the drop of the hat. And so, you know, when I talk to people at the Kavanaugh hearings, they're basically like, the left is united against us and will come out in the streets and will make up stuff about us. And they, you know, they could do this to anyone. So there's this idea that Trump is both a stand-in for individual conservatives, but that also individual conservatives feel as if they themselves are receiving this backlash against them. And then they see Trump getting the same thing and they recognize that. But then when you talk to liberals, they're just like, conservatives are in lockstep. They're all united. And if we did anything, they would just come out with their guns. But I'm like, no one is in lockstep. No one is united. Everyone is mad at each other and mad specifically at people within their own circle. And it's just so interesting to see this idea of the other as being like, you know, we are doing things in order to please a group of people we do not at all understand or interact with. And it's happening kind of on both sides of the political spectrum.
Take a break.
Let's talk about a white paper.
Do a quick paper.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
So this week's white paper, it's interesting because it's something that I think a lot of people have been asking about. And namely, that's when people are like, why can't we vote from our phone? Well, it turns out people have been trying to figure out whether or not you could vote in congressional local elections or even at the federal level from your phone. And so there is a pilot in West Virginia, and the paper is called Under the Hood, the West Virginia Mobile Voting Pilot. And it's from Larry Moore, the founder of the Clear Ballot Group, and Nimit Swamy, founder and CEO of Votes Inc., which was the app that people use to attempt this voting mechanism. And basically in 2018, West Virginia launched the nation's first mobile voting pilot for voters in that specific area. And people on Android and Apple smartphones, you could be if you were an authenticated registered voter, you could receive, mark, and submit a secret ballot from anywhere in the world. And it was interesting to me because, you know, part of this has to do with blockchain managing these particular cloud networks in order to provide security. And they were able to, you know, learn basically how this would work in general. And, you know, I think one of the fascinating things, you know, the paper kind of goes into the mobile voting process. It basically, you would, you know, you email a form to the county clerk with email or online selected, you get authorized, you get this app, you submit this app there, you know, it actually seemed relatively straightforward. And I think something that was interesting is that, you know, people seem to be, you know, 98% of the 147 people who completed the one-time authentication process submitted their ballot, and every submitted ballot was counted. And, you know, it seemed like the authentication process seemed pretty straightforward. And so it was an interesting pilot program. Again, you know, we're talking about 183 voters who submitted these forms asking to be able to do this in 24 participating counties in one state. So this isn't a kind of, you know, we're not quite on the, like, let's take it to the federal level yet. But it is interesting that this is something that people are already starting to think through, especially as, you know, in many states. And I think that, you know, I could, in my, you know, home state of Ohio, there have been issues with this in Florida and Georgia, where voting machines are, one, easily hackable, and two, easily breakable. I think it's interesting that how this paper kind of lays out that there is the potential for another better way, maybe.
I mean, I think we should be clear about the number of requests. You know, there were 183 requests from people who were eligible, which, given this pilot, like, given the particular concerns of the state official who had ordered, you know, who, like, put up the order for it, people, you know, foreign service and military personnel serving abroad. So there were, like, 200 requests from people who were ineligible but still wanted ballots. So presumably these people who, like, weren't in the counties that were doing it, weren't people who were serving abroad. Like, I think it's an indication actually that there might be broader interest in a broader pilot than just saying we really, really, really want to make it easier for people who are abroad to submit things via app.
Yeah, I mean, you know, voting has become such a fraught question in the United States, right? There's this, like, particular context of West Virginia and people being abroad and the assumption that West Virginians who are abroad at any given time are likely to be military members, right? That seems to be driving a lot of this, right? And it's like a super duper Republican state where there's no question as to who's going to win the election anyway. You know, and it's like, if you open this up and you were saying, like, well, the purpose of this is to make it really easy for, like, college students and whomever to vote, are you going to get, like, a whole radically different kind of change? I mean, it's part of the just, like, basic rottenness of voting in America is that without some kind of consensus that, like, it's good in principle for it to be easy for people to vote, it's then hard to work on voting mechanics in, like, a sensible way, because you really don't have that, right? And like, people on, you know, I don't want to totally both sides it, but I do think it's true that it's, like, it's accepted practice in the United States that, like, shaping the electorate is part of how you play the game. So everything is seen through that lens rather than seen through the lens of, like, this is public service delivery.
Yeah, I mean, that also kind of raises the big, you know, tech question for me, which is, yes, on the one hand, there's an increasing amount of skepticism of the current regime of electronic ballot machines and desire for unhackability. At the same time, one of the problems with the current regime is the lack of paper trail, which is why you see a lot of voting reforms that are designed to produce an automatic paper trail that makes sure that, you know, is designed to ensure that people know that their vote was recorded in the right way and wasn't switched post facto. So while the kind of distributed blockchain technology works in protecting external hackability, it cuts against the kind of internal efficacy. How do I, a voter, know that the state government or county government or whatever counted my vote the right way and didn't secretly switch it and not tell anybody?
Yes. I mean, it struck me when I went to witness a federal election in Germany, how much having just a really, really large number of polling places and a really small number of questions on the ballot and then doing it by paper, like, how actually easy that was. There were, like, you know, big differences in the political systems. It's like they basically only had two questions, so it was really fast to fill out. But they just, like, they had a ton of polling stations, so it was really fast, even though the underlying technology they were using was, like, comical. Like, literally, they were just, like, cardboard boxes that people were dropping these papers in. But it was awfully nice.
One of the other elements you mentioned in there is frequency of voting days and ballot questions. And this is probably a good time to note that if certain states definitely have primaries today that have not necessarily been super well publicized. So if you are not in Washington, D.C. and actually have representation in Congress, et cetera, you should maybe consider checking and making sure that if you're listening to this on Tuesday, October 8th, you're not about to miss an important election.
All right. With that, we got to wrap this up. We're getting crazy, frenetic hand signals from the studio. As a very special word, there's going to be an extra Weeds with Mayor Pete Buttigieg tomorrow. We sat down with him, talked about his prescription drug plans, an interesting interview. And so with that, thanks to all our sponsors, everyone listening. Thanks to our producer, Jeffrey Geld. And the Weeds will be back on Friday, but first, we'll be back on Wednesday.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.